Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting are Caroline White, Deputy Editor, and Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. A little later, you can hear Charlotte's interview with superyacht owner Thomas de Vargas Machuca, who has a very beautiful classic sailing yacht called Puritan.
Absolutely. In fact, I know I talk about having a shopping problem on here sometimes, but this guy really needs help. He's bought so many boats. I couldn't quite get over it when he was listing them off and when I was doing my research for it. And they're all really interesting too. There's a number of 10-metre racers that he's got from the Edwardian times in various different stages of repair. He's got one from 1907 called Astarte, and a 1911 yacht called Tonino that the King of Spain used to race on way back then. Anyway, Puritan's a really beautiful boat, and one of the things that struck me from the interview is how he almost had to court the former owner, who was a member of a big Italian family, the Ferruzzi family, to try and buy it off him. Because in a way, it's almost like adopting a pet, isn't it? You have to convince people that this boat, this pride and joy of yours that you've been painstakingly looking after all these years, they have to be convinced that they're selling it to the right person. So the former owner wasn't interested in huge sums of money. He just wanted her to go to someone who was really going to care for his baby, basically. Anyway, you couldn't find a more devoted, wonderful owner than Thomas, so I'm not surprised he convinced him. He's done everything by the book. He's used the best crew, the best staff, not cut a single cost when it turns to maintaining her and keeping her original features and that sort of thing. And he's such an enthusiast. He spent the past 2 years making a huge book all about Puritan, so he knows everything there is to know. But you can hear all about that later on, and he's just a fascinating guy, really interesting to talk to.
I met Thomas a few years ago as well. I met him in his office, and he just struck me as the most passionate devotee of classic sailing boats around. So I'm sure that will be an absolutely fascinating interview, so stick around for that. All right, let's kick it off with some hearty congratulations for Emirates Team New Zealand. They have successfully defended the America's Cup after beating Lunarossa 7-3 in the America's Cup match. That's the second consecutive win for the Kiwis and the fourth overall. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said on Twitter, "Team New Zealand has once again made us all so proud by retaining the America's Cup. We want to see it all over again in 2023. The government has already agreed that the successful America's Cup team will be supported to stay together while it plans its next defence of the old mug." That's really important, that point, because the thing about the New Zealand team, is they are part publicly funded. Well, since that statement, in typical America's Cup fashion, it's all been happening. We know now that the Royal New Zealand Yacht Squadron, the sponsor of Emirates Team New Zealand, has already received a challenge for the next cup. And we understand that to have come from the Royal Yacht Squadron of Cowes. If confirmed, it would mean that INEOS Team UK, the British team, will become the official challenger of record for the next America's Cup and will have a say, therefore, in yacht design and the protocol for the competition. Although I should add that it's expected that the teams will stick to the AC75s that have raced in Auckland, because frankly, to start again from scratch on a whole new design would, I think, suck a lot of the energy out of the cup that has been built up in recent years. So there's also been talk of a one-off race for the cup between Emirates Team New Zealand and INEOS Team UK around the Isle of Wight as early as next year, which would be taking the cup right back to where it all began in 1851. The problem is, as explained earlier, for Emirates Team New Zealand is that they are a publicly funded team and the coffers are basically empty after an exhausting campaign. INEOS Team UK, on the other hand, are backed privately by Sir Jim Ratcliffe, one of the country's richest men. So he could just throw a ton of money at the problem, and which could ultimately lead to a one-on-one showdown between Emirates Team New Zealand and INEOS Team UK in as early as 2022. Obviously, personally, selfishly, I would love to see these two teams racing around the Isle of Wight, kind of bringing the cup home. What a spectacle that would be. Understandably, there's been some grumbling about this plan from the Italian and US teams, who would be locked out if the current rumours are to be believed. Anyway, the situation is still pretty febrile, with lots of briefing and counter-briefing, and it's fair to say there is considerable support for the next cup to be contested in Auckland. We'll keep an eye on things, but one thing's for sure, it is never boring where the America's Cup is concerned.
Just a note here that if you want to read Ben Ainslie's reaction to INEOS Team UK's loss of the cup, as well as the ultimate result, then do pick up a copy of the June issue of Boat International, where he has a column.
Thanks, Caroline. And now from the America's Cup to Colonel Gaddafi. If you haven't seen it already, we have a great story on boatinternational.com at the moment about a Sunseeker Predator 95 that was once owned by the Gaddafi family. The boat ended up basically rotting in Malta after the overthrow of the Libyan dictator, and it's now been picked up by a Norwegian company called Green Yacht, who want to install hydrogen power to turn it into a zero-emission motor yacht. And I'm praying they're successful, as it would truly be a groundbreaking achievement.
I love this story. I so enjoyed reading it and hearing all about it. And one of my favourite things about yachts, I think, is the fact that when you take one on, you take on all its history, its previous owners, its adventures, its whole story, whether you like it or not. And this is just such a brilliant reversal of past from Gaddafi's yacht to the world's first zero emission luxury speedboat, where the only emission, if it's successful, would be drinking water. I mean, how cool would that be if they pull that off? And when it's finished, they're hoping it's going to be used for functions, for teaching sort of Scandinavian school children about the environment on and that kind of thing. But my favourite detail from the piece is that they're going to retain the helm chair that only Gaddafi was allowed to sit in. And someone quoted in the piece said, even when it wasn't his yacht anymore, no one else was allowed to sit in that chair. And I was thinking it was the same on Saddam's yacht. Like, no one was allowed to sleep in his bed or touch his barber's chair where his moustache was groomed. So something to bear in mind if your shipmates have seemed very possessive of their areas on board lately. You might want to keep an eye on them.
So that reference to Saddam's yacht there is all about a feature about Saddam Hussein's super yacht that is going in the
July issue.
July issue. There you go, listener. Have a look out for that. Actually, that's a great story as well. So do, don't miss it. We're talking about yachts with histories. So this story about Gaddafi's boat and another one that's appearing in our May issue about the restoration of the 42-metre Fedship Istros got me thinking about a thought experiment. If I think about it too long, it really melts my brain. So have you ever heard of this thing called the Ship of Theseus? It's one of the oldest thought experiments in Western philosophy. So this was the ship of the mythical Greek king Theseus and the founder of Athens. The legend has it that the ship was preserved after he died for many centuries. Each time some timber on the boat rotted away, it was replaced with a new timber until eventually none of the original timbers were left. The question then becomes, is it still the Ship of Theseus? And I think about this often when it comes to big rebuilds of superyachts, ones like Milani or Shamara or even Marala, which is at Pendennis now. So much steel is replaced on these yachts. Can they still claim to be the original yachts? On Istros, for example, the entire superstructure was removed and replaced, actually, with a brand new aluminium one. How much of the original Istros remains?
I've got a comment here. This is going to be my only opportunity in my entire life to make use of my philosophy degree. So it sounds a bit like Heraclitus, who is an ancient Greek philosopher who said you can never step into the same river twice. And the idea is that everything is in flux. So the idea of the river is that when you put your foot in it, some waters are touching your foot. And then the next time you put your foot in there, it's different waters. So it's a different river. So everything is in flux all the time, and we just superimpose ideas of permanence on these things that are in flux. So arguably, even the original boat was in flux, perhaps at a microscopic level. It was deteriorating, it was changing. So there was never an unchanging thing called Theseus's ship. And the idea is just something we've superimposed on it. So we could arbitrarily superimpose that idea on the new Theseus's ship. Do you see what I mean?
You're saying that there was never such thing as Theseus's ship.
Exactly. There was no objective truth. There was no objective thing called Theseus's ship.
I love the idea of you like explaining this to a shipyard mid-build. Like, well, what even is a boat anyway?
Yeah, no, that's good. I like that. So here's another one. So a later philosopher added another element to this. So if the rotting timbers from Theseus's ship were stored somewhere, were taken off and stored, and some later technique or technology was found to save them, and they were then used, those original timbers were then used to build another ship, would that one then become the Ship of Theseus?
Yes, if you decided that that was the Ship of Theseus, we can just assign anything.
I say if you have the boat, even if you take loads of stuff off it, it's like the essence is the boat of the original boat. And you can't just take chunks off it and make something else.
So you couldn't, Charlotte, so if you went and bought the old steel superstructure from Istros, chucked a new hull on it,
Yeah.
You would refuse to, you couldn't then call it Istros.
No, I would, because that's the boat. I mean, it's not really a position I'm going to be in, Stuart, so I'm not losing sleep on it. But if I was, if I bought it, partly because, let's face it, if you bought the Istros boat and then someone said, oh, you can't call it Istros anymore because you replaced too much aluminium, you'd be annoyed.
Yeah, very.
Exactly.
So I'm not remotely smart enough to figure this out. I lack the classical philosophical education of my colleague Caroline. I liked your answer, actually. Basically, just you do whatever you want to do. Is that the sum of the argument?
Yeah, I think that's what the ancient Greeks would have said.
Do whatever you want to do.
Call it whatever you like.
Exactly.
Okay. So if you're in a similar amount of mental anguish, here's some balm for your brain. The Ocean Awards, Charlotte.
Yeah, I was looking at this only this morning. This is live on the website now, so you can check out all the finalists for this. There are 7 different categories, and every year I think the judges have such a tough job deciding, because apart from anything else, it's very hard to measure what success looks like when it comes to ocean conservation. Is it gathering lots of data, or groundbreaking science, or capturing people's imagination, significant personal sacrifice? They have to weigh up all these different factors, and they do an amazing job doing that and take it all very seriously. But on that last point, that's something that never fails to amaze me about it, is how much certain individuals contribute. There's a local hero award, and it's so humbling to see the lengths some people go to just on their own. So no big grants, no army of staff supporting them, very often thankless work, which doesn't make them hugely popular. But they do it anyway because they want to make a positive change. So, for example, this year there's a man, there are a few projects listed, but there's one man called Pak Tono in Indonesia, and he's been trying to save the dugong population there. So those are those fabulous creatures that people used to say were mermaids, or other people call them sea cows. Anyway, although they're protected, local fishermen still, if they get them stuck in their nets, they'll still then sell them at market and they get a lot of money for it. So it's a bit of an issue. And single-handedly, he's been trying to set up community-run patrols of the coast to keep untangling these nets to make sure it doesn't happen, and trying to come up with a zonation plan to stop different incidents happening and getting the whole community involved with this. So it's one of those things that sounds kind of small when you listen to it, but so often I think it takes someone like that to inspire other people and get the ball rolling. And you only have to look at the Lifetime Achievement Award, which you can also see the finalists for that online, to see what one individual can achieve over many years of dedication. It can be really quite substantial. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see who wins that. But on another note, My Octopus Teacher is a finalist there under the Public Awareness Award, an amazing film on Netflix. Have you guys seen that?
So I loved My Octopus Teacher. I never set out to watch it. Like, often you come across these kind of things on these streaming services, you think, oh, I'll give it a go, and then it kind of changes your life. So it was in one of those moments. I was just idly flicking through Netflix. And you know, you add things to your list in Netflix, so you end up with this vast list of stuff you never watch, but you think, oh, I'll just stick it on my list because in the hopes that one day I'll find the time to watch something. It had been sitting in my list forever. But it was the one moment I thought, that's it. I am going to watch My Octopus Teacher. And actually, it was transformative. It was absolutely amazing. I never thought I could be so absorbed about a story about a bloke and an octopus.
I don't know anyone that has seen it and hasn't loved it. It's like unanimous. Everyone that's watched it comes away with the same reaction. But I love it. It's very gentle and it's kind of very moving as well. But as a lifelong calamari lover, it's had a negative effect. It's really put me off kind of eating octopuses. You have to watch the film to find out why, but I don't feel I can now. It's maybe the gateway to vegetarianism. I don't know.
Why are the most intelligent animals always also the most delicious, like pigs, but to be as intelligent as dogs? Very sad.
Yeah, well, it's worth watching. I recommend it. It's really good.
Yeah, I do too. So if it's sitting there gathering dust in your Netflix queue, watch it. That's my recommendation. So that's part of the Ocean Awards, which is this amazing annual awards program just to celebrate people who are doing wonderful things for our seas. Is that basically right, Charlotte?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it makes you realise that there are so many different elements. There are yachts doing great stuff, and there's individuals, and there are, you know, even if you look at the finalists, there are incredible buoys that you can attach off the back of your boat that gather data. There are all sorts of different things. And this is really our kind of effort to acknowledge the most interesting, most amazing new things happening. But even just reading the finalists, they're all doing amazing things. And it's great inspiration if you do want to get involved with something or you want to get some kit for your yacht to see kind of, they're really thoroughly vetted, as I said earlier, by the judges. So anyone on there is really worth getting involved with, whether they win or not.
For our American audience, I'm just going to point out that we don't advocate attaching buoys to the back of your boat. We attach buoys to the back of your boat.
I fall for that every time. I need to learn to double translate. But yeah, not buoys, buoys.
Yeah. It's just a public service announcement there. Right. on with the news. Caroline, what do you got for us?
Well, to start off with, we have some rather sad news, and that's the death of Albert Hackfort Sr. at the age of 80. Described as one of the guiding lights of the yard and its workforce for decades, Albert Sr. joined the family business in 1955 and spent 60 years growing the shipyard. The Hackfort Yard received the Netherlands Royal Designation in 2020 November, which, as the yard said, was the crowning achievement for a man who did more than anyone to earn the yard that honour.
It's a fantastic shipyard, Hackfort. They build some amazing boats, and it's just in this kind of chocolate box Dutch town. And then you're kind of driving through, and the postcard scenes everywhere you look, and there's this enormous shed rises out the middle of the town. And there's some of my favourite yacht photography is actually shooting boats. I remember the 64-metre Scout, when it came out of the Hackfort shed, it was one of the biggest boats they can possibly fit into that shed. And it looks like there's not a millimetre to spare around the boat as it's coming out of the shed. It's brilliant photos. So yeah, very, very sad to hear about Albert, but what a fantastic legacy he's left and a brilliant shipyard that he built.
Absolutely. Well, moving to Italy and some slightly cheerier news, the Italian superyacht builder Ferretti Yachts has launched its new flagship, the 30.5-metre Ferretti 1000. Built for a French owner, Ferretti Yachts also revealed that a further two hulls in this series have been sold. The carbon fibre yacht has exterior designed by Filippo Salvetti and an interior by Ideatalia. Salvetti has described the forms of the exterior as simple and clean cut. Inside, there are two options for interior themes. You've got classic, which includes soft, traditional tones, and contemporary with bolder colours and more urban influences. Introducing the new model at Boot Dusseldorf in January 2020, Ferretti Group COO Stefano De Vivo said the yacht would be the biggest 100-foot boat on the market. He compared it to the Riva Corsero, which he said was the largest volume boat on the market at that time, and he said it would be even bigger. So that will be something interesting to get on board, I think. Staying in Italy, the fledgling Italian builder Antonini Navi is to build a 56-metre military-inspired custom superyacht named OPV-56. Designed by Fulvio De Simone for a European owner, OPV stands for Offshore Patrol Vessel, and it has an appropriately tough-looking exterior design. The yard described the design approach as functionalist, with austere lines, and every aspect has a clear purpose. It'll feature a foredeck helipad, an aft deck measuring 150 square metres, and an upper deck entirely dedicated to the master suite. I do recommend going on our website to take a look at that, because it has a very cool exterior design. I haven't really done it justice here. I think you have to take a look.
Yeah, I agree. Great, great looking boat, this. When I saw it, I flicked it onto Miranda, the news editor, immediately, just because I wanted to prioritise the story, because I think it's just a cool looking boat. Tough looking machine. And just a quick note that to remind you that all the links to all of these stories and anything else spoken about in the podcast we'll put in the description. So just head there and click for more. The data story this week is really nerdy for you guys out there who like to get into the weeds. So Caroline, tell us more.
Yeah, so as Stuart has suggested, this week is not very glamorous, but we thought we'd give the petrol heads a treat and talk about engine manufacturers. After all, this equipment does lie at the heart of all of the beautiful yachts that we cover. And special credit here to our colleague Raphael Montagnier, who did the research for this. In 2000, just two companies, MTU and Caterpillar, had the lion's share of the superyacht market carved up between them. If we look at all 24-metre plus yachts delivered in 2000, MTU had just under 49% of the market and Caterpillar 30%. All other manufacturers combined accounted for just over 21% of the market. A decade later, in 2010, although 75 more yachts were delivered that year than in 2000, those market proportions remain pretty similar. But by 2020, things had changed. Last year, 339 super yachts were delivered, and MTU's share of those had reduced to just over 43%, while Caterpillar's had shrunk from nearly 32% in 2010 to little over 11%. Between these two had snuck MAN, with 27.4% of the market, and also climbing the rankings, Volvo Penta had increased its market share from just 2% in 2010 to more than 9% in 2020. So basically, we went from having two main players in the superyacht engine market to four by 2020. In order, those are MTU, MAN, Caterpillar and Volvo Penta. So what happened? Well, MTU became the market leader at the end of the 90s, especially after the purchase of Detroit Diesel in 2000. The success of their engines is largely down to their efficiency and performance with low consumption. But they are more expensive than some others to buy and to maintain. The advantage of Caterpillar is that they're robust, less expensive and easy to maintain wherever you are in the world. So what did the newcomers bring to the table? Well, MAN was mainly used for smaller yachts, but in 2011 they became part of the VW Group and developed their series, making them more competitive in the superyacht sector, albeit mainly in the 24 to 30 metre category. We can see that MAN's emergence has really impacted Caterpillar's share in this smaller market. In 2010, Caterpillar had 28% of the 24 to 30 metre market that year. In 2020, that had shrunk to just under 4%. MAN, meanwhile, used to represent 7.8% of engines in the 24 to 30 metre market, but last year, MANs were on nearly 42% of superyachts delivered in that size bracket. However, Caterpillar remains stronger in larger size brackets and is still one of the strongest manufacturers on the generator side.
I'm really interested in this, mostly just because it's come up in a few pieces where owners have been adamant that they wanted Caterpillar engines and that they've kind of gone to extreme lengths to get, you know, to get a Caterpillar above any other supplier. But it's interesting to see that the tables are turning on the smaller end of the market for sure. People do have sort of extreme loyalty to these things. They know what they want and they know why they want them. So I reckon the competitors must have to be very impressive to change the tide.
Absolutely. It'll be interesting to see if there are newcomers to the market, perhaps in the future as well.
Mm. Well, the classic cliche about cats is that, you know, you could be in distant Borneo and you'll find a cat engineer down the dock. You know, you can get them serviced and maintained and spare parts wherever you are in the world. Such is the robustness, I suppose, of their supply network.
Well, turning to the fourth manufacturer in our sort of top rankings, Volvo's recent success in the yacht market is almost certainly linked to its revolutionary IPS system, which was introduced in 2004, although it only became popular more recently for larger yachts. These Volvo engines may step on MTU's toes more than others, since they are successful for similar reasons, efficiency and compactness. So that might be interesting to watch.
So basically, when you look at the market as a whole, nothing much changed between 2000 and 2010, but in the last 10 years, there's been considerable change, with MAN really upping their game. So looking across the entire market, of all superyachts delivered in 2020, MANs were installed on 27.4% of all deliveries, up from 4.1% a decade earlier. And Caterpillar's share of the market had shrunk from 31% to 11.2% in 2020, in just 10 years. Wow. But yeah, like you said, you know, it's all about areas of the market. See, Caterpillar are much stronger in the bigger end. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Well, if you like that or you found it interesting, then do go to Boat Pro, which is our market intelligence platform, which you can access at boatinternational.com.
Thanks, Caroline. Now stay tuned for Charlotte's interview with Thomas de Vargas Machuca.
So today I'm joined by classic yacht owner Thomas de Vargas Machuca. Thomas owns a staggering number of boats, clearly someone with a bit of a shopping problem, and they're all absolutely fascinating, including a stunning 38-metre schooner Puritan that was built in 1930, which we'll talk about in a second. There's lots to discuss there, but first, Thomas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlotte.
So it's hard to know where to start with this interview because there is so much ground to cover, but seeing that as this is a yachting podcast, I thought let's start with the boats first. Can you give us a rundown of what you own currently?
Oh gosh, yes. So let's start with the smaller yachts first. So I, over the years, I bought a number of 10 meter racers. These are an Olympic class from the Edwardian times, the oldest being 1907 and the youngest being 1914. So they come with the names of Marga, which is very well known, which I own with a couple of other partners. And then I bought Linthe, which is a Max Ertz 1908, Astarte, which is a Lilligren 1907, 10 meter international rule, and then Tonino, that was owned and raced by the King of Spain in that period, which is also 1911. And then we have Fantasia, AKA Moana, that was her name, which is a Johan Ankers designer. So, and what's wonderful about that is actually you have, you know, a completely different set of designers for the same rule, because obviously Tonino is a Fife, Marga is a Lilligren, but Lilligren was a pupil of Nathaniel Herreshoff. You have Max Ertz, who was a German, you know, guru when it came to racing yachts, and he was also behind Germania and some of the bigger, you know, class yachts of that period. That was the yacht of the Kaiser, who raced obviously against the other notable yachts westward and whatnot. And then, of course, Johan Anker, who again was a Scandinavian and very quick and very capable, yachtsman and designer. So they show different interpretations of what the 10-meter rule should have been. The 10-meter rule being effectively a formula where the result has to be the same for everybody, but the interpretations can be different. So if you have a wider beam, then you have to compromise on your water lines. If you have a higher, taller mast, then you have to compromise on your draft, as long as the output is the same. So we're all trying to achieve the same goal with different ways of efficiency. And it's great to have a portfolio, for lack of better words, of different boats to kind of test the efficiency under different conditions of each designer on different boats for that period.
I mean, it must be fascinating to see how they all compare and to handle them out on the water. And I don't know if you can say, of the boats, which one do you think is the most successful in terms of how it handles?
Well, it's really interesting because, the one that, we've raised for a while is Marga, which was the first one to be restored and finished. And we also got an award for the best restoration because we all used authentic craftsmanship to do that. So we basically backtracked and said, what would they have done in 1910 when she was launched, and that's the technique that we did. So we cast the bronze work, and all the corking and all the fastening were done in the same technique that would have been done in 1910. Of course, we think that William Fife will probably be the most performing boat, simply because we know that Fife has never done a slow boat from that perspective. But we have to compare. If you take Fantasia, the Johan Anker, that will be really, really interesting because that's got the longest water lines. And of course, if any naval architect will tell you, the longer the water line, the faster the boat. But the beam is very, very thin and your freeboard is different. So depending where the wave is coming from and what wind conditions, they will perform differently. So I don't think there is a definite winner. I think you sail them with different conditions. I mean, Marga is an absolutely fascinating boat when setting downwind. We typically make most of our time on the back legs. This was a project where we took effectively a scrap boat, found the history of her lineage, restored it to the exact specification of 1910, and came second in Saint-Tropez after many years of finding the right crew and actually one of our crew members, Umberto Molinaris, is currently in New Zealand preparing for the Defenders because he's the grinder on board the Prada Pirelli Luna Rossa.
So you've got a good crew on board.
Well, I think it's great that they can be so ambivalent to go from foiling to classic yachting, and I just think it shows you how intellectually interesting classic yachts are, irrespective of whether you are the guru and at the highest echelons of sailing, you still have time to do the season with the old folk, because it's not about ultimate speed, it's about complexities of the maneuvering and the coordination between the different stations. So we love that element of it.
We'll come on to the restorations in a bit more detail in a second, because that's how I sort of found out about you, knowing that these boats are in different stages of the project. But I spoke to an owner once before who was telling me about this incredible classic restoration that he'd done. And he said the best thing about owning a classic boat is that everyone else is so excited to be part of it as well. You know, like, people give up their time. People are happy to race for you because they just want to get on board. You own this incredible toy that everyone wants to play with. But let's talk a bit about Puritan, because that's obviously a much bigger boat, and that's the more super yachty of your collection. Can you sort of start at the beginning there and tell me sort of how you found her? I know that you already owned a reasonably large sailing boat at the time. Were you looking for something, or did you just see her and fall in love with her? What's the whole story there?
So it's really interesting because, yeah, so Oreanda so my first boat was, again, a John Alden from 1939. It was an unregistered design, but, you know, very similar to the Malabar series. And she sailed in Italy, and then was taken over by the head of the British fleet in Trieste for many years. And then it became a club boat for the Circolo Adriatico. And then, you know, I kind of outgrew that. I mean, you know, Delfino was just under 60 feet, and I found Oreanda, who was being sold by these Spanish family. And Oreanda had an amazing story. In 1937, a staysail schooner, so a Bermudian rig, which measured about 85 feet. Because I really wanted to go and do some long distance sailing, having read this amazing book, which talked about, you know, finding Easter Island. Right. So it was The Mystery of Easter Island, written by a lady called Catherine Rowledge, who was a prominent member of the Royal Geographical Society. Their schooner was called Mana, built in Scotland. And this was the same, similar size. Of, you know, that was my dream before, you know, obviously work kind of took over. And after many years of owning Oreanda, we started, you know, making sure that we could share this passion with other people. So when I wasn't on board, the crew would entertain and have guests on board. That built up a charter if you want, market. And it became relatively successful to the point that when I wanted to go on board, there was some paying guests. So I said, hang on a minute. So and really, through the experience of the 10 meters, I really wanted to go gaff. You know, because, you know, when you've got a deep passion for something, you kind of prefer the hard way than the easy way. So whilst you super appreciate how, you know, gaff was let go and Bermudan rigs picked up and all sorts of, you know, other equipment that helped you in your sailing, you kind of want to regress into the rabbit hole. So schoonering, you know, became an important element, and gaff schooners are, you know, at the pinnacle of all of that. So we started looking around, and I looked at a number of different yachts. And then it just occurred to me that the Puritan had so many of the features that I wanted. I mean, first of all, one of the few last original schooners, just simply a time warp, which I particularly liked. Steel hull with a very high gradient of carbon in it, which is a testament to her construction in the 1930s. And I can go on for days and days and days about that and the Electrical Company of Connecticut who built the hull. And more importantly, Puritan has a very rare retractable centerboard that you lift by using a grinder on deck. And that was important because most of the boats were kept and are currently kept, you know, in Italy on the River Tiber, where the shipyard that I use for certain works is located. And to be able to sail up the River Tiber, I've only got X amount of draft. So by pulling up the centerboard, I can actually sail up and get to the shipyard. The complexity being that what you don't want to really do is have different boats in different shipyards, as much as you can avoid that, because it's very difficult to be on top, you know, from a governance perspective, to make sure that you've got hands-on approach with the shipyard, with your crew, with the advisors, with any element that is involved in either the maintenance or the restoration of it. So we built our team around the Rome area.
Was she in Italy at the time? How did you actually come to know of her, or had you always known about her?
Well, Puritan is you know, famous worldwide for her history and for her owners and and everything that's in between. But she was owned by a very prominent Italian family who were one of the big sponsors of the last successful Italian campaign on the America's Cup, which was the Ferruzzi family at the time of the Moro di Venezia, which was the last time Italy had a defender, having won the Challengers Cup, which was known as the Louis Vuitton Cup. And she was always in Antibes. So every time you sailed into Antibes for other reasons, whether it was racing at the Val d'Antibes or whatnot, you saw this amazing schooner with people on board, always in immaculate conditions. So cheekily, I asked one of my advisors to see whether she was for sale. And of course, everything is always for sale.
One of those, for the right price, right?
Well, I think actually, to all credit to the Ferruzzi family, it wasn't really about the right price. Of course, that's a given, but it was to the right person.
Yeah.
So I needed to really show my pedigree, because Arturo wouldn't have wanted to leave Puritan to just somebody who was going to buy it without maintaining the ethos, because he kept her as original as possible. And he did say, we tried to change the least amount of things that we necessarily, unless we necessarily had to. So he was very peculiar about who, and I had to engage through friends who had friends who knew him well to advocate Thomas will be the good next owner. And since we've become great friends and he calls me for my birthday, last year he gave me one of the original blocks from 1930 that I still hold as a birthday gift.
When you made those initial inquiries, were you surprised when then you started to progress it? Did it feel like, oh, I'll ask, but nothing will come of it? Or did you have quite a strong campaign to think, I want that boat and I'm going to push to get it?
Look, the reality is that I played open cards and it paid off dividends, because I said, look, I'm not looking to have any other boat of a bigger size. That's really not, but Puritan, it's given something to me. I shouldn't say it. I should downplay my enthusiasm, but I can't lie, because it transcends my physical. And I said, and unfortunately, you also have the centerboard, the retractable centerboard, which makes it the only boat I could possibly have unless I wanted to move all operations elsewhere. So I said, I'm playing open cards, and what are you thinking? And he smiled and he said, oh, you remind me of when I was your age and all the rest of it. And we found that we had common friends, or at least my family had common friends with him. And that had helped a lot in kind of making sure that he realized that I wasn't, some guy interested in buying the boat that he treasures so much, but I would be an appropriate next custodian during my ownership.
Do you know if he'd had previous approaches that he had kind of turned down because he didn't think they'd take as good care of it?
The answer is yes to that.
Yeah.
Because the apparently the questions that they were asking were not schooner questions. And so he would say, thank you, but no thank you. I don't have to sell. And I will keep on, I'll keep her until I find the right owner for it.
I can completely understand that, though, because when you go to so much trouble to keep something original and to restore it, as you really don't want someone to come along and undo all your hard work in a one fell swoop. So it's great that he found a kind of like-minded enthusiast in you that he felt he could trust with the project almost. It's not a boat, it's a work of art, really.
Well, correct. And the thing is that, there's a lot of humility in owning classic boats. Because, it's always very difficult to think that you can outsmart the geniuses who built them in the first place.
Yeah.
And it's so often I've seen that everything that was done in period was absolutely of a quality that is very difficult to find today. And any addition that were done in the 50s, 60s, and 70s were actually the weak link in the boat.
Yeah.
These guys were proper maritime engineers and naval architects, and a lot of trade and movement was done by sea. So they were at the top. I think we've regressed in terms of not necessarily our knowledge, but our usage of these boats, because we now use them for sporting and for activities and leisure, and they're more toys than they are, but at the time they had to withstand, some pretty harsh conditions, and that's how you sailed around. So your knowledge was very high, and the boats were built to last forever. The fact that Puritan is 90 years old and hopefully we'll have another 500 years to go is a testament of how well she was built in the first place, as other ones are as well.
And can you remember the first time you stepped on board when she was actually yours and kind of how you felt? Because it sounds up until now like quite a logical decision, like it ticked various boxes for you. Was there a kind of moment where you stood back and you're like, wow?
So we did the sea trials, and it was very difficult to find a slipway that was available to haul her out of the water to inspect, you know, the hull and the centerboard and everything, because of course, the boat hadn't been sailed for a couple of years. She was just very well maintained with the crew, but you know, barnacles and everything get everywhere, and the only slipway that we found was in Elba that actually had the drawings of where to put the straps to haul her out of the water, which is not something that you can just do so easily unless you have a dry dock kind of setup. And it was only after the successful due diligence of the hull that we signed the bill of sale.
Yeah.
And so then I joined. I took the car to took the flight. Flew into Elba. No, I took the overnight ferry, got into Elba, and the next day I said, "Oh my goodness, this is really now mine." And I scratching your head, going, "Okay." And with my captain, who's been with me for now 12 years, and we've gone through so many things together, we started all getting into the details of all the list and of all the different areas that we wanted to address in terms of her restoration.
And did you do, I mean, it sounds like she was in pretty amazing condition when you got her. Did you make many changes in terms of the interior, things on board, or is she pretty much as you bought her now?
No, so we did a lot of work to the boat, but mainly because I gave her a commercial license, and that has all obviously health and safety, so we did quite a bit of work on the hull, where the thickness of the hull goes below a certain width. You need to kind of restore it. So we did works on the hull, works on the centerboard, on the prop shaft. We overhauled parts of the engine. We redid all the air conditioning, all the pumps, any leaks from the heads. We restored all of the galley. We repaired new top masts, turnbuckles, parts of the main mast. We redecked the entire boat, the hatches.
Quite a lot then.
Yeah, the boat is probably in the best shape she's been since being launched in 1930. But it's fine in the sense that because we sail roughly 5,000 miles a year. Because we go all over the Med, from basically, France all the way down to Greece and, into Turkey and back up and all the rest of it, and because she has a charter license, and because we have dedicated, guests and clients who come on regular basis who feel that it's their boat as well as it is ours, because they're regular, charterers, we need to make sure that everything is absolutely fit for purpose. You don't want to reverse it or over-engineer these things, but you want to make sure that you get to the bottom of whatever it is. So, classic yachting is not about being smart. It's about not being penny wise and pound foolish. So certain things, whilst you do one, you really may as well do the other.
And
it was the right thing to do.
And did you use all the same kind of teams and craftsmen and people that you've used for your other projects, or did you have to seek out any experts in certain areas or people that you hadn't worked with before?
So we with the shipyard, we found different agreements and with the crew to kind of work together as a unison team, because of course, you've got to look at these from a long-term perspective. So there's always a work in progress. So you want to try to keep the team as intact as possible, because they're the last time that they looked at whatever that part of the boat, and therefore they will know at what stage of repair it needs or decay or it doesn't pay off to go to different suppliers around the world and play the kind of invoice reduction kind of or cut costs because you end up saving on one side, but then the knowledge gap can be so significant, you've actually lost the trick and it ends up costing you more on the other. So we did that. We did that. Now, of course, there's always rotation with crew, because obviously they we need to nurture that. So we do that with the classic yacht experience. But we had Alex Child, who'd been a schooner man for many, many years. He worked on Altair. He worked on other notable boats, Merrymaid, and so on and so forth. And he became our officer on board, so to speak. And he comes from a very old British tradition of carpenters and painters and people who've been involved. So he was really, together with the captain, the very, you know, the top guys making sure all the works was being addressed. Charlie Couture, he did 5 seasons with us, another great carpenter. So, you know, and varnishers. So we kept that team in place, but of course they need to dream and they need to, expand their own life's career and move from boat to boat. So they become, you know, and it's a small world and they always come back around and sometimes, you know, and they come back in a few years and take more prominent positions and these will be the captains of the future. So you, you know, with one side, you go on and be free and you know, we'll sorry to leave you. You know, and on the other, you wish you could say, no, you have to stay here forever because
it sounds like they come back. Yeah.
And but they're equally as torn. But, you know, it's probably about, you know, it's like when children leave home and they go to, you know, school or university. It's always you understand it, but it's a sad, you know, moment nonetheless.
Well, I was asking you before we started recording for the podcast, you know, had you looked into her history at all? And you told me, yes, I've looked into it so much I've spent 2 years writing a book. So, I mean, it sounds incredible and it sounds very beautiful. You were saying it's in this incredible box and it's sort of an Aseline style big coffee table book thing. I don't know, it sounds like an incredibly rich and long history, but maybe you can pick out a few of the most fascinating things about her or the things that really resonate with you and have importance to you.
Well, I mean, look, I think there are two things. I mean, for me, one of the things that make me, you know, an enthusiast with classic yachts is the history, the idea that so many people have seen exactly what I've seen and have gone through the exact same, you know, issues sailing her and, you know, top mast, non-top mast and, you know, whatever weather condition. I love that, you know, time warp. I mean, you know, it's these are very precious moments. Yes, and her to acknowledge that there wasn't a story, but there were just these random stories and speculations and myths, which of course would be born in a bar fueled with rum, where somebody misinterpreted what the other person said about the history of Puritan. I needed to set the record straight, so I embarked on this.
So this is the definitive history of everything you've ever heard about the boat. The rumors are true.
One of my crew members, she worked as a chef on Orianda, was actually trained as a researcher from Nottingham University. I said, Frankie, you know, do you want to move from, you know, working in the galley to helping me on this? And she did. And so for 2 years, she became the in-house researcher and she's done an amazing job. So we worked together on that. So I got her to write it. And I wanted to, you know, pollinate and make sure that she had an ongoing career in all things yachting and editorial and books and, you know, so on and so forth, a bit like you, Charlotte, presumably. And she did that. I provided the forward and I provided my insight and, you know, and the more management of it and say, oh, I would structure it this way. And, you know, I think we should, you know, I don't want it just to be a factual list of what happened in the chronology. But I want it to be almost like a docu film, but like a docu book. So while you read it, there's actually a narrative.
It's coming to life.
And I won't tell you what the name of the boat, of the book is, but you know, it's almost a novel, but it's actually the history of the book. Now, nothing is fictitious in it, but we've written it in a way that is more of a novel style. So you follow it on as you read it. Look, there are notable periods. I think it's the interconnection between Puritan and so many other boats, because of course she served also in the Pacific during the war, together with other notable boats such as Te Vega and others. And it's to realize that when you go through the history, you say, gosh, you know, there she was. That's the picture of Columbia. I saw Columbia the other day. The owner was a friend of the Priya. The captain was related to this. You know, look, I think the funny thing was the span of different activities she did. You know, she was used to we found out that there's actually a mollusk called the Puritanese Boweri, which was found in Baja California when she was used. She was gifted for Harry Bauer, who was the owner at the time, to the National American History Museum, who did an expedition to go and find, forms of life in an area in Baja California that hadn't been mapped yet. Mm-hmm. And they found a mollusk that had not ever been seen. And that takes the name of Puritan, of Puritanese Baueri, representing both the yacht and Bauer, who was the owner at the time. We found that she served in the Pacific during the same time that my American grandfather served in the Pacific. We found articles of her being beached after hurricanes. She was involved in scandal. She was involved, presumably, in drug trafficking as well.
Really?
At the time of no ownership. Yeah, when she was seized by South American authorities. I don't want to give too much away from the book. I want people to read it.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's striking me is, how is all this recorded? And everybody had this knowledge. I mean, people gave us videos of her in the 50s and 60s. They had on the little video machines of the time that we also have.
We'd love to see some of that and share it. We could maybe put it on our site and people could have a look.
Yeah, and it's amazing. Some of the contributors are no longer with us because, and they kept religiously all this details of invoices. I mean, we have a box of invoices from, the 1950s. I mean, who keeps that? And somebody kept them without knowing that one day it would be an integral part for us to know what had been done where. So you can actually go on the boat and point at that and almost have the right invoice to go. That was done in the refit from Camper Nicholson in that year. That's still the original piece from the Electrical Company of Connecticut. Ooh, that was done in California during, it's quite mind-boggling.
Amazing. And how do you feel about having kind of all this history on your shoulders? Because I've heard kind of classic yacht owners before saying it can be a bit of a burden in that people are paying close attention to what you do. And you're very aware that you're not just taking on a brand new boat. You're inheriting, like you say, so many careful owners who've put their love and attention into this thing. And now it all rests on you. Does it ever feel like a pressure or is it just purely a joy?
Look, it's the duty of care. It's you don't really get into classic things generally if you don't have the desire to make sure that you tackle the problems that inherently they have, and you prepare them so that you give the best chance for them to survive and get other people to enjoy them for however long it is. And if everybody does that, that's how these things last. Now, clearly. Mm-hmm. Certain yachts and houses and cars and paintings and have an aura around them, which is why some carry on existing and other ones are lost, to memory, or to history. And Puritan definitely has that. I don't think it's a burden. I think it's more of a privilege. Mm-hmm. And we use it very much to try to have a different story in terms of saying, look, classics are fun. They're cool. They're different to modern yachts, but not everything has to be about performance and speed, but it has to be about passion and dedication. And whether it's a modern yacht or it's a classic yacht, dedication, time and passion are both key elements. One goes towards something which is performing less on the, a speed side and, but you're losing in speed, you're gaining in complexity, and it's the overall experience. Which is why I call the company the Classic Yacht Experience, because it's an experience. You're doing the same thing just in a harder way, and a lot of people like that. Not everybody, but so. I think the burden is only in a bit like the Ferruzzi's, is to make sure that whenever it is my time to let go of Puritan, it's let go to somebody who follows on in the responsibility of being the eighth in line of a generation of owners who've loved her and maintained them and didn't think they could rewrite history by improving some of the things that definitely need to be improved, but you don't, because that's how she's kept original.
And are you looking for someone now? If someone came up to you now and said, I open cards on the table, I really love this boat, are you ready to part with her yet? Or do you think that's too soon?
I think it's an interesting question, because the way I set up the kind of the whole principle of the Classic Yacht Experience is to do it together, right? So it doesn't have to be binary, either or. It's mine and this is my possession and that's it. I don't really work that way. I work more with sharing the experience. So if there was a like-minded person who said, Thomas, can I co-invest in the holding company? I would say, sure, if you want to do part of this thing together, this is how we operate. This is, look, I'm obviously a businessman as well. So transparency is absolutely key. Arm's length, everything's accountable. We have a great team, of passionate people. So yeah, I'd be open to that because let's face it, I'm not going to live on board. Neither is he or she, you know, but you know, my family, their family should enjoy it. And when they're not, obviously there's charters on board who also enjoy it. And that's good not only for, you know, covering certain costs of it, it's also good for the crew because crew people, you know, to get schooner people, you know, they're all a little bit, you know, they've got loose screws like I do. So this is why we all work together so happily. All right. But you can't keep them in a port.
Yeah.
Because they want to climb up on a mast.
Yeah, yeah.
So the boats have to do something all the time. You know what I mean? So otherwise they get bored, and quite rightly, they will choose to go and work on a boat that does something else, cross Atlantic crossings, round Cape Horn, racing, you know, whatever. So my way of, you know, of squaring that circle is to say, okay, do the charters around the places that we like, in ports that we know, to offer different experiences in different places that are of cultural or topographically interesting. And sure, and if you want to join as a co-owner, there's a shareholder agreement, join, enjoy it as a co-owner, which is a level up than just being the charterer.
And how often, the answer is yes. Thank you. How often do you manage to get on board? Because you were saying with Orianda, you found it was more often occupied than perhaps you'd have liked. Do you manage to get out on her? I know it's been a weird time the past year or so, but in general, do you manage to use her as much as you'd like to?
Look, I mean, obviously we, you'd want to use things so much more than you ever do. Look, realistically, between all the boats, I used to spend between 3 and 4 weeks over a 6-month period. So, you know, I quite like the early season sailing when the ports are empty and, you know, it's a bit like, you know, early dawn when the day hasn't started yet and they're all still resting from the evening and it's slightly coming to life. Mm-hmm. So early, you know, May sailing in the Mediterranean still offers that, you know. And then sometimes in September, October, on the way back after, say, Saint-Tropez or whatever. So on average, I've done about, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks on Puritan, you know, and then some other racing on the 10 meters, you know, that's on average. Some years more, some years less. I mean, last year, I think I was on board only 2 weeks.
Really? So. And what does the perfect day's yachting look like for you? Is it quite sedate or is it kind of pushing the boat a bit? What do you love doing?
No, we have a rule on board that if we have more than 8 knots of wind, we have to go sailing. That's a sailing boat. I mean, otherwise, you know, go to a hotel and enjoy the pool. I mean, there are plenty of other activities. So we choose, which is why, you know, I love Greece so much from that perspective, because you're always guaranteed an evening breeze or a thermal wind that allows you to set the sails up. And so typically, you know, we'll wake up in the morning, you know, varying times depending on how long the chat in the evenings on deck have been the night before and how much you know, rum has been consumed you know, to the late hours of the night, you know, and then we'll wait for the breeze to come up and we'll typically have, you know, 2-3 hours sailing, a few jibes, a few tacks, a few you know, point your nose out there, get to speed, you know, check the balance of things, see whether you could improve on the angle versus the previous day, have fun, you know, put everything down, and then you know, relax for the evening, giving the crew the time to obviously do the reset from sailing to kind of more hospitality. One of the great things that we like to do to Greece is really sail from effectively the edge of the border with Turkey. So you say from Patmos and make your way all the way back up.
It's so beautiful around there anyway. What a place to sail.
Oh, you're sailing 3-4 hours a day, island hopping. Then you go and you explore, you know, Folegandros or whatever bay it is, you always find a safe haven, you know, wait, and it doesn't matter. I mean, 2 years ago, we were stuck in an extraordinary Meltemi summer, extraordinary because typically Meltemi dies out in the early evening. And this thing was just blowing even at night, and you still find a great safe haven, and you're doing 4 hours proper sailing at, you know, 14, 15 knots, nice heeled over, very, very sporty stuff. Really, the day becomes a very, and then you put your nose in, everything calms down because you're protected. You hear the howling wind and you feel as if you're 1930 because no one else is out there sailing, but schooners are done to do that. And you make your way all the way back up and you, yeah, it's, and these are the things that we try to orchestrate in the Classic Yacht Experience.
And I'm conscious that we could talk about this forever, and I need to ask you some questions about you. But sort of lastly, what is the stage of the other boats? Because I sort of heard perhaps you were interested in selling your other smaller boats, or that you were restoring them. Where are they at? Because I don't know how you have the time to work on all of these at once. I can imagine it's well, a bit much.
Look, it's partly the time, obviously, and or partly the same principle of having people come in and share the passion and the burden to finish the restoration of the other one. So, you know, Astarte is probably 80% done. Mm-hmm. It's currently being worked on. Tonino has had quite a bit of work done. And then Linthe is the one that's still in a shed, you know, basically a design. Mm-hmm. And Fantasia has had the initial due diligence done. What's good about it is that we've got already all the investigation of what the ultimate cost is. And the good thing about the 10 meters is that they're all very similar in terms of size and shape. So we've got a whole system that will tell you how much we spent on Marga to be able to backtrack to know if we're overspending on the others. A lot of the difficulty when it comes to Classic Yacht or any restoration really is to really make sure that your estimates are as accurate as possible. And so having recorded every single, you know, how many paintbrush does it take, how many coats of varnish does it take, how many hours of somebody who's capable versus somebody who's less capable does it take, you know, we've got it fine-tuned. So we have different stages of development, but if there are people who wanted to join in to relaunch the 10 meter class that hasn't raced against each other for more than 100 years, I'm more than happy to do that, as we did with Margaret, which was why I bought all the other ones too.
Well, there you go, listeners. If that sounds exciting, you can get in touch and let us know. I was going to ask kind of what is it that drives you with these projects? But to me, it's quite clear that you just have a passion for the history and kind of what's gone before. Does that sound right to you?
It does. And restoring them authentically and making sure that the carpenters in our world have good jobs still to work forward to, and that we don't, you know, we don't forget about where we come from, because if we don't know where we come from, it's very difficult to know where we want to go. And that applies to people and to things equally. And there are a lot of craftsmanships that today are not given the right, appreciation. And yeah, master carpenters and sailmakers and everything which is either maritime or classic car related or classic buildings are trades that should be protected. And so if we can act as a catalyst to do that, philanthropically, if you want, you know, is one of the drivers.
Let's talk about cars for a second, because I know that you're the chairman at Hero Era, which is this leading classic car rally organizer, and you do things like the Peking to Paris rally, which I've heard about. I've interviewed a couple of people that's done it. It sounds like so much fun. In your head, is yachting and the rallies, is that the same kind of thing, or one is relaxing, one is adrenaline? You know, where do they sit in terms of your mind?
I think, you know, one is the most amazing thing you can do off land, and the other one is the most amazing thing you can do on land. But I think they're similar in their kind of general ethics, so to speak. Again, restoration, understanding, you know, it's not all about speed, but it's the complexity of what you're doing at whatever speed it is. Now, clearly, the Peking to Paris Motor Challenge is our flagship event. I mean, that's like crossing the Atlantic. For all intents and purposes. So that's, you know, you're camping, you're solving problems, you're in the middle of the Gobi Desert. It's pretty miserable when you're out there, but this is the challenge, otherwise it's not. So, you know, and it's no different to sailing in really rough weather, you know, across the Atlantic, or let's just say coming back from, from the US back to Europe sailing. So you've got good headwinds, you know, and you get to the end of the day and you pull into the Azores and you're absolutely shattered. Your muscles are aching. You can't even hold a glass bottle. So, you know, it's same thing, but different medium. So they're very comparable from that perspective.
And what are your experiences with, because obviously you're restoring cars, you're restoring yachts. Do you find both of those projects very similar, or is one industry a lot easier to work in, or do you have very different issues in restoring cars that you don't come up against with yachts?
So, you know, cars by and large, you know, have been, you know, kind of mass produced. So yeah, there are a few cars that are, you know, individual cars that, you know, have no real, you know, kind of blueprint that you can follow. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit easier to go and find out how they would have been. So when you want to restore them originally, you've got enough documentation.
There's less detective work then.
Yeah, yachts are one-offs. Yeah. So you have to go and, you know, when you can't salvage something, you have to go and research and interpret what the spirit would have been done and make sure that you can back it up by having examples. So, you know, on Puritan, you'd go and look at another John Alden, mm-hmm. and say, okay, well, look at what he did on Malabar. Look at what he did on that other one. Okay, ooh, it could have been. And at least you've restored it to something that would have been, you know, kind of comparable from a similar designer. So yachts are more complicated. And of course, every line item is more expensive on a yacht than it is on a car. Even though you can spend a lot of money on cars too, if you want.
And what car do you drive? I'm intrigued hearing all about the boats. Are you allowed to say? Are there many of them?
Well, I drive a few cars. I don't really own modern cars other than an electric vehicle for London, of course.
That's interesting. So you're on the electric bandwagon then?
I'm not on the electric bandwagon at all. I'm actually testing it to be not somebody who speculates, but through experience. And there's quite frightening things that have happened to me on the EV,
really?
You know, I think it has a space in mobility today, but I think we're all a bit wrong footed if we think it's going to solve a lot of the issues. And the internal combustion engine, I think, has a lot better ways to be more carbon friendly, which I am obviously very sensitive about too. I just don't think the EV is a solution in any stretch of the imagination, the short term or the long term. But that's another conversation for a different podcast.
Okay.
I'll be competing on the Pekin to Paris with a 1914 American La France, which is a chain driven former fire truck, which has a 9 liter, four cylinder engine. It's effectively a huge truck. I'll be competing with my good friend, Ben Cousins, who's the chairman of the Royal Automobile Club. And we're trying to get from Pekin to Paris. Obviously, I'm chairman of the company, so I need to do it the hardest way. So we're the oldest car, and we're trying to go from Pekin to Paris on the rally with no external mechanical assistance. So we're going to try to do it on our own steam. So next week, or whenever lockdown finishes, I'm meeting up with the guy who's restored the wooden wheels.
Guys
are the same techniques as the guys who build the masts for Puritan, because it's all about wood, you know. So that's a great kind of car. Look, in the countryside, I love my Series 1 Land Rover. Mm-hmm. Good little agricultural runaround. I don't, you know, you use different cars for different things. So it's just difficult to say which one do you prefer, which one is your car. They're all I would have them all if I could. I have to stop.
Well, you have to keep us posted on the rally. That sounds like that could be fairly uncomfortable, but wishing you all the best for it and hoping that you don't need any assistance. I was interested in your background, because obviously you're in London right now, are you?
Yeah.
But I read that you have correct me if any of this is wrong, Italian father, American mother, and you've obviously spent a lot of time in Italy. So what's your kind of heritage, and where feels the most like home for you?
Good question. So, you know, obviously I come from an old Italian family with Spanish, lineage. So Italy culturally, obviously, you know, I declare myself being, you know, kind of half Italian, because that my blood is half Italian. I think when it comes to work, I tend to be a bit more British on certain things. My passion is definitely more on the Italian side, but you know, obviously there's a lot of British. I was born in London and educated in Scotland, so you know, the British, and I've been living half my life in the UK, so you know, the British element is super important. I think the American element I love as well, that there's so much more of a go-getting, trying to you know forget about the problem, let's look at the future kind of thing that I get from my mother. So I would say I would say that I treat equally my Anglo-American side and my Latin side, I think, are equal contributors to what I do. So I generally think it's the UK has been a fantastic working environment for me. It's how I I was an investment banker for many years, and then I became CEO of listed companies in Germany in the residential space, and then actually it was between banking and my roles as a CEO that I took over Hero ERA 12 years ago, and we grew it from absolute nothing, little cell, organizing a couple of rallies in the UK to actually a platform that organizes about 16 rallies across the globe every year. So it's quite, which also now, does a whole bunch of different activities. And I think I wouldn't have been able to do everything that I've done if I hadn't been so lucky, in having such a different cultural background than most people have, being able to share the American side, the British education, being born in the UK, the Italian side, being able to travel. So, my privilege and responsibility is to make sure that I don't squander all that. And that I spend my, my days, creating value for those who are associated with us, with me directly, and make sure that, I'm on the right side of the argument to make sure that people who are as privileged as I am actually act positively for the wider community, as opposed to being, egocentric.
Absolutely. And in terms of, cars, boats, other things in your career, is this something that was always part of your family life growing up? It sounds like it probably was.
Well, history. Yeah.
Yeah.
I used to scoop around in the family library and find out what ancestor had done what at whatever point in time. I think the history element, really comes from that. My father, who I adore very much, he taught me how to drive, on his lap when I couldn't even get to the pedals.
What did he drive?
He loved Lancias.
All right.
And he had, various Lancias. And whatnot. I mean, he had a number of different cars, but so he kind of transmitted the car thing to me, because everything from, come on, let's go and clean the car together, give me a cloth and drying it with him and to make sure the details and other things. So that's for sure. The yachting came a little bit later. I had a fantastic girlfriend for many years, whose family had a classic yacht. Right. And I was invited every summer, and I became very good friends with the captain and the crew, almost dismissing the fellow guests on board, because I was having more fun with the crew than I was with other guests, and that prompted. And then my father had bought Delfino, and I basically bought the project off him and finished it up. So he's an important part of my life. So yeah.
I was going to say, is he still involved with the projects today?
No, not really. I mean, he is as my father and my guest on board. I make sure that he takes the more leisurely elements of it, and none of the financial burdens or the intertwined complexities of restoration and all the management things that comes with a fair share of complexity. So for him, it's all a perfect world now. He's 80 and he's deserved it. So.
And does he ever offer any perspectives? We all know how kind of opinionated parents can be. Does he ever say, I wouldn't have done it that way when I had Delphi, we did X, Y, Z? Or is he happy to kind of let you take the reins?
No, he's very happy. I have to say, he's a great guest on board, because he respects the boundaries of my participation and his. So no, actually, from that perspective, no. On the cars, a little bit more, you'll say, "Oh, did you make sure that was the yes? Absolutely." So, on the yachts, it's more like, "Well, you've taken it to a different level." So.
Oh, well, that's good. And are there any other passions at play? I mean, it sounds like there's more than enough to keep you occupied. But is there anything else that you just love doing and are a big enthusiast for?
Look, I mean, I've got a wonderful girlfriend, and hopefully, we'll be lucky to progress to the next level and have children at some point. We bought a country house in Oxfordshire, which is a 15th century Grade II listed property, which were similar to the boats, restoring with painstaking observations from the conservation officers. And they're kind of a little bit bemused that we're not trying to cut corners. And we're like, oh, great. Oh, this is the original beam? Fantastic. How do we make sure that everybody appreciates that? And they're like, no, you mean you don't want to take it away and put a jacuzzi in there? I'm like, no, you don't want jacuzzis in there. You know, I want hygiene in the bathrooms, but I didn't want to change the charm. That was the whole purpose of buying that place in the first place. So that's a project on the go. And, you know, and hopefully it'll be a great hub where people come with their classic cars, you know, to have good cigars and talk classic boats as well.
I mean, that sounds like a dream for anyone. It's interesting what you say about the interiors renovation of the property, because I've heard it said before that owners of yachts that have done things beautifully on yachts have then been incredibly disappointed on land when they've been getting architects, builders, tradesmen. I even had an owner said to me once, he took the team that were doing up his place in Parma round his boat and said, look at what's on here. I want you to replicate this quality in my house, because he just found there was such a big gulf between yacht craftsmanship, which is obviously in a completely different plane, and then what was happening in his home.
Correct. It looks same thing, and that, you know, homes are so standardized, you know, that it's very difficult to find, you know, the guys who will work and you know, I don't know, replace the molding so that it follows the contours of a wall that's been sitting there for, you know, 500 years. It's just not economically viable. Whilst you know, and that's one of the things that, but you know, some guy will come up and will create a little. So actually, let me tell you a fun story. So I met a guy who is a phenomenal dry stone waller. Okay.
Right. Yeah, I know that they're hard to find, the good dry stone wallers.
So this guy wanted to be a mechanical engineer, but found out that he was dyslexic early on, and you know, he kind of took it on the chin, and he's under 30 years old. Okay. So all kind of depressed, he goes and, you know, goes to his family, and the father says, look, don't worry, just help me out on the farm. And they had to fix a wall. So they'd hired a dry stone waller. And the guy worked his entire summer to fix, you know, the dry stone that was on their property. And he fell in love with that. He learned the trade from the stone waller that they'd hired. In the meantime, he now has 5 stone waller that he's now trained. He's, you know, 29 years old. Wow. He is, you know, you have to book him a year in advance. He does everything from Blenheim Palace to all the other proper properties, you know, and that's it. And I asked him, I said, Zach, and he said, well, you know, I thought, you know, I wasn't intellectually out there because I'm dyslexic, and I just, you know, I wasn't as performing as I needed to be to be in the engineering world. And then I realized that I had 10 fingers. And these fingers are actually pretty well organized among themselves.
Yeah.
So he's built a fantastic trade. His enthusiasm is absolutely, you know, breathtaking and engaging. And that's it. And I love that story, you know, so that we don't all have to be engineers, bankers, advertisers, lawyers, you know, and somebody thinks outside the box. And he said he's the happiest guy. He's a perfectly viable business. He's an entrepreneur, and so on and so forth. And he's also apparently a pretty capable navigator and classic cars. So there you go.
You'll have to get him to join your team, hey?
I told him he will. He will, absolutely.
And sort of business-wise, how has this year been for you? Because obviously we've been in a similar situation in that, you know, travel's clamped down, events aren't really happening. Presumably lots of your rallies, it's caused some disruption. So has it meant more downtime for you? Has it been a bit stressful? And what's going on in the future?
I think not all evil comes to harm. And I think that there's been a good time for a lot of people to kind of look at the priorities. I think that's a good thing. As myself, as in my roles, we had to work 5 times as hard because you're protecting your staff, the people who work for you. You know, the further down the line they are, the more protection they need. At least that's the ethos with which we do things. So we had to work very, very hard. Fortunately, you know, we our companies were capitalized sufficiently to be able to weather the storm, whether it was through, you know, monies that we retained earnings from the different companies, whether it's because we had specific insurance. You know, obviously, I think various government supports have helped in any case as a gesture. I don't think they quite cut, you know, the pie the way they should, but it's certainly, you know, so we were able to run 6 events this year. We only did the UK events, and we didn't do the long distance events. The only international one we did was the New Zealand Rally, which finished in the middle of the pandemic. By the time people came back from New Zealand, there was a pandemic, but three weeks before,
so you just scraped in there.
So that was the last one. But it's fine. You know, we actually hired staff, incredibly. And we did a lot of the groundwork that you typically have difficulty doing because you've got the various teams and different contents organizing different rallies. And as far as the Classic Yacht Experience is concerned, I mean, one of these things, who knew? We had a pretty good season last year because everybody wanted to be away from areas where you're necessarily in contact with more people than you need to. And yachts tend to be a perfect way to do so. So, you know, a lot of our charters were island hopping and, you know, doing everything that was perfect in terms of making sure we had, you know, our staff was testing every 3 days, every time they came back. So with a speed, you know, testing systems that were there. So, and we had the season almost unscathed. So, you know, a little bit of judgment, a lot of luck, of course. We're lucky to be in the position that we are. We're looking forward to obviously things lifting. And I think we'll be stronger than we were before, certainly intellectually, because this has been certainly a groundbreaking year for humanity to rethink things. The wonderful thing is I won't have to fly as I used to New York for one meeting and come back. I think that's finished.
Yeah.
I think a bit more downtime. I think family time is on the up. I think people, the ability to take a breather, I think is on everybody's mind. I think paradoxically, it's about now seeing the people you want to see rather than having to see all the people that you have to see. And I think that will have for in the short term, it will still be there. Then inevitably we'll forget about it all and we'll go back to our old human habits. That's what history tells you. Or, you know, it does
be interesting to see how everything unfolds after a year or so when things change. Well, final question then, you've got all these different projects on the go. Is this kind of peak renovations for you now, or are you still kind of, could you be persuaded to get an extra boat?
Look, it's a good question. I don't think you plan these things. They kind of land on your lap, and these are almost instinctive things that that you do. Look, if I had all the money in the world, which I don't have by any stretch of the imagination, I would restore them all. I mean, I would do carpentry schools. I would replicate Lovestoff. I would do, you know, I would just, you know, what's money there to do if you don't use it for things that you feel passionate of? And you know, my passions are in looking at people who do the things that I'm not capable of doing. So who knows, maybe the lottery will treat me favorably, in which case we'll embark in a few more restorations.
Well, absolutely, thank you so much for being so generous of your time. It's been fascinating to talk to you, and hopefully we can have a longer chat on a boat in the near future.
Indeed, looking forward to it, Charlotte, and all the best to all your team too.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.